Hi everyone, welcome. Maybe we should start. I know I'm not your usual professor. I'm Chris Yates, a friend of Dr. Marsh's, and from time to time he lets me come pinch hit for him. So he asked me to come and teach today about Simone Weil, and I'm happy to do this. As you will have noticed, a rich body of ideas. You've already done some work in the last class on this text. Is that right? And no?
We were just in Bonn.
Okay. But it's been assigned? Okay. And I assume you've read it. So I mapped out some sort of a key to where I want to go today. And I'll be doing lecturous kind of things, but also asking you to help each other out and help me out as we go. First, just a few personal introductory points about my feelings about reading Simone Weil. I've been drawn to her. I did my graduate work in philosophy, but before that I did an MA in religious studies. And so along the way of both of those worlds, I found her and drawn to her as a very intriguing and inspiring puzzle in many ways. She has the ability to confuse me in a productive direction, I think, right? I think, you know, and I find inspiration in that, even if I go back and forth in my mind about where I agree with her. But she's fascinating because her work is hard to categorize and her life is hard to categorize. And what I mean is that how she thinks doesn't really fit a traditional academic discipline. And how she lives showed some curious, courageous choices. She could have easily become a kind of academic superstar as a philosopher, but she chose not to. You will have read some about her biography. I imagine if you read the introduction of the book, if you haven't, I highly recommend it. A life of deliberate solidarity with the poor and the factory workers in Europe, taking on in her early life Marxist causes and then moving out of that. But there was no separation for her from the world of ideas and the world of practices. And in her Christianity, which she came to in a very unique way with a lot of hesitations, no separation between theological commitments and practices. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that sets her apart in a lot of 20th century history. She's not the only one, but hard to place. Not an individualist. Her Christianity is not about an afterlife so much as about a this life, this world, the abundance of faith incarnated here. Right? She is willing to hesitate about chief tenets of Catholicism like baptism. You will have read that in her letters. She's willing to change her beliefs on purpose, thoughtfully. I think that's a rare thing. Right? She's willing to live in hesitations. She doesn't rest in ideas. She's restless. And she doesn't treat ideas and beliefs as commodities, which maybe we can talk about this later, but I would argue is one of the perils of our culture today. Maybe it's inevitable, but sort of moving to a kind of worldview opinions, almost as brands, almost as fads, even though we're very earnest at times. And finally, just my impression of her and why she's intriguing and inspiring as a kind of puzzle is that she's acutely, obsessively aware of how the giving of attention is a central human task and opportunity. This is a philosophy of attention. The giving of attention is central to who we are, and it's something that is very vulnerable, yet very promising, too. It has to be done deliberately, but with help, and in the context of things like friendship. She's very nervous about the damage that can come from what we could call misguided clarities. Misguided clarities about truth, religion, justice, politics, the church. She's very nervous about that. That's how I come to this. What about you? Can I hear some impressions from you so far? What is standing out to you about her life and her ideas so far? How maybe is she different in her thinking than other things you've looked at? What might be inviting in the way she thinks? Or what might seem remote to you? Somebody help me out so we don't live in awkwardness for too long.
I'm going to be honest with that. Say I did not get to the reading, but I did read the introduction. And based on what I've read of her, the way she like worked in the factory and participated in the Spanish Revolution, like she's very impractical for the average person. And instead, like she has certain things suffered like worse than the other factory workers, just because of like her own decisions. And that, I don't know, seems just to go overboard. Not pointless, but.
Like actually impractical, like as a strategist, or she would seem impractical to the world around her.
Well. As a strategy, like I mean, I guess for her personal journey, it's fine. But like, I always appreciate when, like, reading somebody that I feel like I can emulate, and I can't like bring myself to emulate. Like,
it's all or nothing for her,
right?
Yeah. And everything since her childhood.
So I thought it was really interesting her analysis of church as a social structure, as well as her own acute awareness and also kind of stubbornness in her own like predilections as to like when she was talking about the Nazi social structure and how, you know, if she heard a Nazi chorus singing, then she would immediately feel at home in that group, so she had preventatively stayed on the fringes of not only political parties but also church patriotism, which was very, very interesting.
And the nervousness about the vulnerability and promise of attention I mentioned is, seems to translate you're saying also into kind of careful outsider status. Nervous about causes, even though she is an activist. Nervous about systemic structures of ideology. Thanks. The reaction so far. Dylan?
I feel like she almost seemed idealistic to a fault. It's like she builds all of her conceptions of things on, and they seem very concrete but and resistant to kind of other perspectives, almost like built upon nothing but so influential in our life.
And
the baptism is a good example of this, yeah. Right, where she is like holding this very belief, and she's obviously spent a lot of time thinking about it and talking with, you know, Father Perrin about it. But it seems like she's too committed to this, like, idealism to really see it.
let's flag that as something to question maybe later on. But yeah, I see that too. For like a strident, I'm going to do it only if it's right. You know. By the way, those letters are amazing. Can you imagine someone writing that way today? Like a thinking in the form of a friendship in the form of letters. Maybe it happens. Thanks, Joanna.
I think she's really sought to live like Christ, very self-denying, perhaps almost to a fault as well. I think, like Mackenzie was saying, she didn't follow not necessarily follow the church, but she separated herself from the church. It seemed her spiritual journey was very personal, very individual.
Yeah. It's wanting to be engaged in communities and longing for fellowship and friendships, but there's a certain, you said, like, there's a certain circle around her self-denial. Okay. Yeah, I wonder what a psychologist would make of this. Okay. It's another, I mean, we can add that as a question mark alongside of idealism. I think they overlap. Does anyone find it impossible to get inside these ideas? Frankly, I mean, it's very spiritual, it's very Christian. You know, sometimes we read stuff and it's just, it's hard to be empathetic. Yeah, a little bit. Let me suggest I want to get to this, but I first want to frame it by looking at just three passages. I'll probably turn us to a lot of passages, so be ready. But we'll start actually with the center, page 59, in the school studies essay. bottom half of the page. Because I want to hear what she's saying, let it become a question for us, and then contextualize it within something that came before in the letters and something that comes after. So she says this: students must therefore work. We all have the same edition, right? I got that. Okay. Students must therefore work without any wish to gain good marks, to pass examinations, to win school successes, without any reference to their natural abilities and tastes, applying themselves equally to all their tasks, with the idea that each one will help to form in them the habit of attention. You see this word almost on every page in this book, attention. The habit of that attention, which is the substance of prayer. When we set out to do a piece of work, it is necessary to wish to do it correctly, because such a wish is indispensable in any true effort. Underlying this immediate objective, however, our deep purpose should aim solely at increasing the power of attention with a view to prayer. Increasing the power of attention with a view to prayer. As when we write, we draw the shape of the letter on the paper, not with a view to the shape, or with a view to the idea we want to express. To make this the sole and exclusive purpose of our studies is the first condition to be observed if we are to put them to the right use. Maybe not something you heard at orientation?
Little joke.
Okay. So the meaning of right use is something we want to work out, and the meaning of attention here, the meaning of prayer, this comment on effort, there's a lot here. But now turn with me to page 23. Middle of the page. At 14, I fell into one of those fits of bottomless despair that come with adolescence. And I seriously thought of dying because of the mediocrity of my natural faculties. Okay, Rachel, the seed of self-denial, maybe here, self-loathing, despair. Okay. The exceptional gifts of my brother, who had a childhood and youth comparable to those of Pascal, I had a brother like this, it's infuriating, brought my own inferiority home to me. I did not mind having no visible successes, but what did grieve me was the idea of being excluded from that transcendent kingdom to which only the truly great have access and wherein truth abides. By the way, there, a clue to her nervousness about being excluded, right? Or kingdoms that exclude. She felt as a child also just a fear of failure. I preferred to die rather than to live without that truth. After months of inward darkness, I suddenly had the everlasting conviction that any human being, even though practically devoid of natural faculties, can penetrate to the kingdom of truth reserved for genius, if only he longs for truth and perpetually concentrates all his attention upon its attainment. There's our word again, attention. A sense of possibility, but also a pathway to truth. There's something very personal in this moment, but something very conceptual. It's the personal and what we might call the theoretical ideas, big picture ideas, mingling in her. And this is how it's going to be, I think it's clear, through all her life. She's not someone who detaches the work of the mind from the experience of the soul. Right? She can't do that. She won't do that. Now let's go to page 100. Jumping over to the essays, page 100. Maybe one of you could read this. Right in the first full paragraph above the middle. Would you mind reading it?
Yep.
Nice and loud here.
We live in a world of unreality and dreams. To give up our imaginary position as the center, to renounce it, not only intellectually, but in the imaginative part of the soul, that needs to awaken to what is real and eternal, to see the true light and hear the true silence. A transformation then takes place at the very roots of our sensibility, in our immediate reception of sense impressions and psychological impressions. Is a transformation analogous to that which takes place in the dusk of evening on a road, where we suddenly discern as a tree what we had at first seen as a stooping man, or where we suddenly recognize as a rustling of leaves what we thought at first was whispering voices? We see the same colors, we hear the same sounds, but not the same way.
All right, thanks. What was your name?
John.
Thanks, John. Another loaded moment. Making, I think we could say, a conceptual point, but with a poetic valence to it. We live in a world of unreality and dreams. Okay, that's a strong assertion. Also, I think a bit of a lament. Plato said we live in the world of the doxa, the world of common opinions, status quo beliefs, and we don't know this all the time, but we're blinded to truth. It's hard to see through the way things seem to the way things are, and thus the path of wisdom is to figure out how to gain that sight. A sense of, okay, that here, we live in a world of unreality and dreams. And the way we try to cope with that, by default, she thinks, is by making ourselves the center of it, ourselves the curators of meaning. So that's got to go. And she uses the word transformation several times. I think that links with what she was calling attention. And it doesn't seem to be a transformation in the sense of, I'm going to discover truth. It's more of a, I'm opening up to having that discovery happen in me. I'm involved, but as my perception is turned, it involves me, but it involves some sort of intervention from elsewhere. I think there we could, you know, the title of the book, Waiting for God, maybe we could stick the word waiting on here, a sense of waiting in the midst of this turning, this transformation. But for her, an active waiting, not a passive one. Like an active attention, not just a receptive one. Now, okay, so hang on to those. I want to work through I thought I would gather up what seemed to me to be seven of her guiding principles. So seven principles, I don't list them here, but I'll just mention them and I'll maybe look at a few representative passages. So the first one, and there's probably more principles, but the first one is her devotion to intellectual honesty. Page 25, real quick. Page 25 in the letters. At the top, the third line down from the top of 25. I have an extremely severe standard for intellectual honesty, so severe that I never met anyone who did not seem to fall short of it in more than one respect. And I am always afraid of falling in it myself. Page 30. Page 30 now. Last full paragraph. She's been recounting some experiences here to Father Perrin. That made me see intellectual honesty in a new light. Till then, I had only thought of it as opposed to faith. This is a really important point. I had only thought of intellectual honesty as opposed to faith. Your words made me think that perhaps, without my knowing it, there were in me obstacles to the faith, impure obstacles such as prejudices, habits. I felt that after having said to myself for so many years simply, perhaps all that is not true, I ought without ceasing to say it. I will take care to say it very often now, to join it to the opposite formula, namely, perhaps all that is true, and to make them alternate. An intellectual honesty that isn't like about necessarily about linear thinking where you go from this premise to that conclusion, right, and you're done. But an intellectual honesty that on purpose tries to hold commitments with a great deal of weight, but also a bit of a, I don't know, there's room for doubt. Even a doubt on purpose. She doesn't say, I ditched the idea that, all this religion business might not be true and moved on. Actually, I gave myself, for the sake of intellectual honesty, some back and forths. All right. She also goes on to talk about realizing that God is not an issue to be solved. God is not an issue to be solved. In the sense of maybe the kind of truth about religion, in her case, Catholicism, Christianity, maybe that kind of truth is different from the way a scientist or mathematician solves something. The sense of truth can be different rather than the sense of factual truth. That happened on, we don't need to turn, but if you're keeping track of any pages to go back to, that was page 22. And on page 52, a related moment, she talks about being skeptical of the cold light of reason. The cold light of reason. She's not opposed to reason, but the kind of reason that takes a distance from the world and explains it or scrutinizes it. The cold light of reason, maybe some of you have to practice this, and it can be very effective. It can be very good. Engineers need the cold light of reason. The cold, clinical, factual, objectivist, objectivizing use of reason. But think of maybe some time when you've gone to the doctor and you have to fill out that survey of everything about you that seems wrong, and all your meds and your family history. You are having to represent yourself categorically in a way that would fit with the logic of medical science. It's not wrong. It's just a little, forgive the pun, clinical. Right? They're not asking you, what do you love? They're asking you, what might be wrong with you? So I say that because there's a sense of a different, in philosophy we call it a different epistemology, a different philosophy of what counts as knowledge, justified knowledge. And periodically in the book she's again saying it's not about separating faith from reason, it's that there is a faith in reason and a reason in faith, and we need to have some finesse here, some versatility, some generosity with it. Okay, the third... gosh, that was all on the first point. I better pick up the pace. Well, the second one is related. Page 138, and that is that... And here I'm going to say something. Here we have a bit of a paradox. This point is that belief is not enough. You need certainty. I was just making for her a case of faith, having a different sense of truth. But now she does say, where is it? The way that top paragraph ends on 138, four lines down. On this account, well, she's been talking about Christian practices. On this account, it is more fitting in what concerns divine things. On this account, it is more fitting. In what concerns divine things, belief is not fitting. Only certainty will do. Anything less than certainty is unworthy of God. Makes us wonder what she means about this interplay between belief and certainty. You know, in a way, it's a puzzle, I said. It's a bit of a... I'm going to write it up. One of the inner threads here is the belief and certainty puzzle. I don't say that to suggest we toss her ideas, you know, that she's broken some rule. Well, I say it because I think it's an opportunity to do a close reading, you know, to sort of really hear her out and see what she's doing here. The idea that she goes on to say that we have to love truth more than life. We do have to love truth more than life. But we have to simply avoid having what she calls verbal beliefs. Spoken beliefs. It's not enough for her. We need it instantiated on the ground. And maybe the idea is that that's where belief and certainty get worked out. Certain about beliefs, perhaps, but a very intense devotion to letting truth penetrate one's soul. She says this a number of times, letting truth penetrate one's soul. All right, so there's some things there we might return to. The third principle is that she does not want to separate herself from unbelievers, the public, or non-Christians, as Mackenzie was saying, or be a part of an institutional church that separates itself from the world and draws a territory to carve out for itself, a patriotism of a religious institution. That happens, for example, on page 32, page 41, page 48. We don't need to turn there. But the idea is that she believes that if there is an incarnation, it's not just about God sending Jesus in the incarnate form of God. It's the incarnation of God's love in this world. The incarnation of God has to be realized. It has to be brought to fruition by us in a kind of collaborative work with God. Just hear the movement of that is not we got to take the world and get a formula to get salvation beyond. It's salvation and the abundant life happen by bringing things to be realized here. Here. And where specifically does she demand that the truth of faith be incarnated in places of affliction and suffering? So, what does that mean? If the church is not open and intent on dwelling with the afflicted, then it's not a church for her. Or if the church defines itself, gives itself clarity about its identity by an us versus them approach to the public or to non-believers, that's not for her. Now, and she's not alone in this, actually. There's a lot of Christian theology that agrees with this. But it is clearly an important priority for her. And this relates to her skepticism, her nervousness about the baptism thing. The fourth point, On one hand, for Vey, the world seems to hold no final good, no final good. She says, 139, 189. So world in a sense of not, you know, it doesn't have ultimate goodness in it. On the other hand, maybe another paradox, on the other hand, the world has remarkable beauty for her. Okay, so the world has a beauty of order and wholeness. Even the way matter follows laws of necessity, it's beautiful, and it reveals a sort of divinely inspired order. And it's in our relationship to the world and the relationship of us and world to God that there's an experience of this, she thinks, of a higher goodness written into this world. Right? Page 104, for example. This is a bit of a scholastic theology in Vey, or even Neoplatonist theology. Is she not? What is she not saying? A sort of cliche version of Christianity sometimes would be, the world sucks, it's going to burn. You know, the kingdom of God is up there. We got to get our pass and go there. That's not what she's saying. So where was I? About seven lines down on 104. Anyhow, we must have faith that the universe is beautiful on all levels, and more generally, that it has a fullness of beauty in relation to the bodily and psychic structure of each of the thinking beings that actually do exist, and of all those that are possible. It is this very agreement of an infinity of perfect beauties that gives a transcendent character to the beauty of the world. The genitive, like the genitival sense of the beauty belonging to the world. Nevertheless, the part of this beauty we experience is designed and destined for our human sensibility. And she talks about how art, you know, is a way to experience this. Page 107, page 113. That interests me very much. That art is an expression of the imagination, can be a way to concentrate on the beauty of the world, the beauty of order. Whereas in a passage we read earlier, she did talk about how the imagination is prone to illusions and fantasies. So there's a sense in Vey that almost everything is highly charged. Art is a vocation of the imagination, can help give a kind of revelation of the divine beauty that's in all this. But it can also not live up to that. And so the world, she says, the world of matter kind of has a thumbprint of the infinite in it. But again, the point here is that we can't attend to this by presuming to be the centers of it. Presuming to be the authority over explaining the order of the world or using it to our utilitarian agendas. A fifth priority or principle for her is related. We are prone, she says, to false beauties. I think this is in the biblical tradition of worrying about idols. But, you know, she specifies these things as riches, luxury, and power. Actually, this is very much in the spirit of the Old and New Testaments. These are what the prophets are usually speaking against. Riches, luxuries, power. And she says, art and science can mitigate these temptations. So art and science can help by directing us to beauty and to wisdom. The job of science is to direct us to wisdom. This is going to relate in the school studies essay, I think. So contemplating things, being helped to attend to things beyond the normal terrain of our desires. So she's worried, again, about false beauties, our vulnerability to these, and the course of our desiring ways. A sixth priority principle for her is the love of neighbor. We've already started to see this. The love of neighbor is a primary way that we involve ourselves in God's love of the world. When we are, self-denial is a way of involving ourselves in something greater than ourselves, specifically through the neighbor, the other. And she doesn't explicitly say it, but she works with the Good Samaritan parable here. Seeing Christ in the other, in the neighbor, and involving ourselves, and again, a turn of attention. A turn of attention away from self-desires, our self-desires. And she makes a very, very, very important distinction here that I know will be crucial to Charles Marsh. And that is, she points out, well, she makes a comment about the problematic distinction. Does anyone remember? Between justice and charity. To distinguish between acts of justice, which is a setting of right, a setting right of things, and charity, like just mere almsgiving, mere giving to the poor, that should never have happened, because the path of charity is a false path. It's okay, but it's not true to the issue of justice. Page 84, may as well look at this real quick. Page 84. This relates to her interest in being the church needing to be close with the afflicted ones. The bottom of 84. Okay. We're in an essay here. Okay, so she says, the text of the gospel is concerned only with Christ's presence in the sufferer. A depth of suffering here. Yet it seems as though the spiritual worthiness of him who receives has nothing to do with that matter. It must then be admitted that it is the benefactor himself as a bearer of Christ who causes Christ to enter the famished sufferer with the bread he gives him. The other can consent to receive this presence or not, exactly like the person who goes to communion. If the gift is rightly given and rightly received, the passing of a morsel of bread from one man to another is something like a real communion. Interesting how she does this, connecting the idea of the Mass or the communion or Christ's Last Supper with the meaning of the gospel as being giving to the poor or the suffering. And I think she probably allows for a very generous, broad view of who suffers here. Just to continue on 85, Christ does not call his benefactors loving or charitable. He calls them just. The gospel makes no distinction between the love of our neighbor and justice. In the eyes of the Greeks, also a respect for Zeus, the suppliant, was the first duty of justice. We've invented the distinction between justice and charity. I think this is, I say it's important to Dr. Marsh because this insight is very much alive in the theology of a lot of 20th century social reform movements. But it's kind of hard to get it. So here, I'll do it here. Justice, usually, if you study the New Testament, the word justice usually shows up as the word righteousness. But they come from the same single word, which is... Does anyone study New Testament Greek? Classical Greek? What's wrong with this school? Dikaios. You know how many times that word occurs in the New Testament? Over 300 times. But when we read it as righteousness, it could have some ambiguous meanings. It might mean just being perfect or being beyond this world. But no, if Simove is correct, it means justice. And justice means, in this sense, the right relationships among all things. The right relationships among all things. I think this relates to what is sometimes called social justice. Active restoration of right relationships, because after all, what did the beauty of the world tell us? That it has a beautiful order. Beautiful order. that relates to the love of God. And so now, a beautiful ordering of social relationships, that's the task of justice. And that is why she goes to work in the factory, among other things, and goes on hunger strikes to be an agent of this, of justice, whereas charity is giving from a distance. Well, today there's a lot of ways to do that, to give from a distance. And look, it's easy to say this. It's very hard to do this sort of thing. Remember when I was talking about truth and knowledge? So just as she doesn't want us to approach the truth of God from a distance, a comfortable enlightenment distance, she doesn't want us to approach the neighbor from a distance. So there's a just way of thinking and a just way of living for Faye. This is an important principle that will relate to the school studies issue. And she's very nervous about power. We have to be willing to let go of power. At times, the first priority has to be what she calls consenting to the other, consenting to the human quality of the neighbor, even the criminal. Never suppressing the form of attention that I think she believes sees the image of God in each person. So then the final principle I find in her is obedience. Obedience, but again, not simply in following rules. I mean, she would have been a real pain to work with, right? If your father parent and she's always arguing with you, that she's in a Catholic social community at this point, she doesn't blindly follow anything or anyone. But obedience, setting aside our default clarities, setting aside our default selfishness, in order to become a more perfect image of God. So obedience, going with things that are right enough, that she's willing to be certain of as matters of faith, as a practice of letting go of the comfort of who we are personally. Renouncing ourselves, renouncing our self-centeredness. That might be one of the things some of you all wondered, is this a little bit too intense? A little bit too idealistic. So I want to suggest something as we get to this, and we are getting to this. And that is to think about how Simone Weil holds her beliefs, like not just what are her doctrines, but how she holds them, because I think this helps us as individuals think about how we hold our beliefs. Not just what they are. And what I mean is that obviously she has beliefs, and they're very strident ones, but she also has a rare self-awareness of what's going on in herself as she has the beliefs. Self-awareness is very hard to cultivate. Very hard to practice a careful knowledge of oneself, especially in the question of, why do I believe this? What are the shaping factors for me to have this opinion about politics or about religion or social justice or fill in the blank? Self-awareness is hard, but she's got a real aggressive devotion to it. So she has belief, and she cares about intellectual honesty, and she won't commit to an idea if she tests it carefully. And even then, she'll leave space for doubt. Okay, so we might wonder how this thing happens today, you know. And I think here that we can say something that I would add here is Simone Weil sometimes is making points about her beliefs descriptively. This happens mostly in the letters. It's very personal. When I say descriptive, it's almost like she's saying, I seem to really believe this. I've thought about it, and it's in me. It's in my soul. It's not just logical. I believe this. I have questions, but I believe this. And then there are other moments where she does it in the form of assertions. This happens mostly in the essays. So my suggestion is that you can actually read the book dividing in two, that there are descriptive statements of her beliefs, and then there are assertions, arguments. Right? She's going for it. And I think the school studies essay is the pivot in this. It's the hinge of the book in that way. So descriptive relationship to beliefs and assertive relationship to beliefs. Look, to make it more practical, think about yourself in the midst of the day and conversations you have with yourself or with others. Any kind of mundane belief or any big belief, any opinion is couched sometimes in the form of, no, this is the way it is. Right? No, it should be that. And sometimes it's couched in the form of, I just feel that this is the right idea. Not, I just feel, you know, but look, honestly, I feel that this is right. You see how we relate to beliefs in those two ways? And so Simone Weil's implied case, I think, is that, okay, yeah, you want to get to certainties. You want to get to assertions about truth. But in a relationship to the descriptive nature of self-awareness, like school studies are going to lead to a great life of prayer. She's insisting on that. But in a way, it's rooted in, I just have found this. It'd be an interesting project to look at how big picture beliefs our voice today, a kind of list of assertive examples in academia, in media culture, in politics, and then also a table of descriptive beliefs. Anyway, assertions and descriptions, and then wonder where there is room for belief and certainty in that. All right. So let's go finally to the school studies essay, and we'll go back to page 59. Remember, I really submit to you that attention is the key word in all of this. And attention in this essay becomes very clear to me that she's not saying pay attention. She's not saying attentiveness is a switch. We flip. Attention is to be a part of a turning around, what she called elsewhere, we saw a transformation. You're being turned, but you're also going with it. You're turning yourself. And so this is a very Platonic idea of the path to wisdom is being turned away from deceptive truth to behold higher truth. And then to turn with higher truth back into the world, he does this in the allegory of the cave, you may have read, back into the cave, which is the city, to practice truth. Anyway, page 59, at the top of page 59, and again, we're just kind of listening to her for now, but I want to react soon. I want you all to react soon. So she says, quite apart from explicit religious belief, every time that a human being succeeds in making an effort of attention with the sole idea of increasing his grasp of truth, he acquires a greater aptitude for grasping it, even if his effort produces no visible fruit. She's asking us to give up something we might be comfortable with. It's the effort that matters. It's not the outcome and the, the sense of grades. It's not that they don't matter. It's just not the point. There is a use. This is the good news. There is a use to school studies. Even at this level, there's a use. But it might not be the use we think it is. There's a right use, as if to suggest there's a wrong use. And to do it with a view to the love of God, what a strange phrase. With a view to the love of God doesn't mean I'm going to study in order to love God. Not necessarily. It means I'm going to study in light of the fact that God is loving. So, what matters is effort in many ways. And at the bottom, she says, we already read above that, she says, the second condition in all this is to take great pains to examine squarely and to contemplate attentively, and slowly each school task in which we have failed. Seeing how unpleasing and second-rate it is, without seeking any excuse or overlooking any mistake or any of our tutor's corrections, trying to get down to the origin of the fault. Okay. There's a great temptation, she says, to do the opposite. Yeah. So, this is hard words here, because I don't know about you, but for me, usually the practice was see my mistakes, have a moment or two of self-loathing, try not to dwell on them, maybe get a little pissed off at the professor, and move on, right? But she seems to say it's, you almost learn more from your mistakes than you learn from studying geometry. You know, she cares about the subjects. So effort, mistakes. And I think these points are fleshing out the bigger thesis she's got moving here. If you go to page 57 at the start of the essay, just take a moment on your own and read especially the two middle paragraphs, and then I want to ask you what you hear her saying. What do you see? What do you hear her saying? This is kind of her thesis statement. I'd love to hear from some new voices, too.
Maybe you pray before you take the midterm. She's saying, take the midterm so you learn how to pray. This is really weird. But, in a sense, what is prayer for Simone Bay? We have to guess with it. It's a form of attention, a form of paying attention. I think it's very hard to crack this essay in some ways to get to this prayer business because on the surface of it, it seems very Sunday school-ish. Do well in school so you learn to please God. Well, let's give her the benefit of the doubt for now. Development of the faculty of attention and increasing the power of attention. The whole attention should be turned toward God. I don't know, other thoughts on this? What do you hear? what else is it not saying? Here or elsewhere in the essay. What do you not hear her saying? If this is a philosophy of education, what is not being said?
What it is we should be studying.
Yeah, I mean, she refers to math and Latin, basically. She's not talking about classes in spirituality. These are just sort of whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so why? How is that interesting? Is that interesting?
Well, it's interesting again, compared with what you, the last sentence of the paragraph, but the whole thing should be turned toward God, because, well, does she want it to be like focused on, you know, academic attention or prayer or both?
Yeah.
I think that perhaps she almost sees prayer as a kind of, you know, we're talking about the incarnation before, it's almost a reverse incarnation, where it isn't so much God coming down to us, it's just kind of the God he is. It's the idea of the incarnation that came down to permeate the whole of our existence. It wasn't just relocation of God, it was kind of filling with this world of God. So prayer is kind of an individual sense of refocusing our life, refocusing our attention on God, and kind of filling our world with God, so to speak, in the entire language. But I think that the purpose of that is that we're looking toward the infinite, we're looking toward something that's fully, you know, beyond us, rather than focusing in on ourselves. Because ultimately, anything that we look at on this earth is going to be limited in our focus and the amount of attention that we can give to it, because limited world, but God is infinite, so there's no limit to how much attention.
Response? Thank you. That's rich. Yeah.
That is, I think I've been thinking a little bit of a different way with the same point, maybe, that maybe in a kind of platonic sense, she wants us to look at the particulars to learn or dwell or embrace the mystery of the forms that we can't understand. We can't truly reach the glory of God or holiness, but maybe through the small particulars that we see, the structure of Latin, if you're looking at the botany of the flower, these small things maybe can illustrate and draw our finite minds into broader sense of the capacity of the whole.
The capacity of the whole?
Yeah, like what all it could be, the possibilities. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, so between these, though, I have a question for both of you, or someone else if you want, but is it, I study hard in order to get better at prayer, in order to wait on God's revelation of the infinite, of his infinite love to me, in order that I can be delivered away from human affliction? Or, I'm not saying that's what you're saying exactly, but is it that? Or is it also about the coming down, bringing God down, bringing the infinite into geometry? You use the word mystery. This is a class on mystery. It's a mysterious class. Suppose someone were to say, there's no mystery in this essay. This is a taskmaster kind of, you know, get on board or don't. So my question is, she keeps talking about the effort of attention, and you all have talked about slightly differently about how it is meant to be a way to liberate us from our problematic desires and possessive approach to learning and truth, and also to receive something higher. Is there mystery in this? Is the cultivation, the practice of school studies with an eye towards prayer and the love of God,
does it come back to this puzzling combination in her of belief and certainty?
Keep adding to my questions, I'm sorry.
Is there a
is there Simone Weil, the mystic, in this? Or is it just Simone Weil, the one who says, don't just believe, but have certainty about what you believe?
I think attention is kind of a mode of thinking for her, so that like when you're like looking at this jump, or like when you're doing the act of like paying attention, it's like a means by which you discover the truth, almost. So like the only way to like be certain, it's almost like just teaching how to analyze something. So if you focus hard enough, and you know, if you translate that to God, you're kind of like really getting in and kind of tuning everything out, and it's kind of just like a mode of thinking.
You said it better than I've been trying to say. Attention is a mode of thinking. Now when I say pay attention, it implies I'm about to give you the answer, right? But she's saying pay attention, meaning search, wait, train yourself, apprentice yourself to being open to truth. And she believes being open to the love of God that is infinite in the finite. Apprentice yourself to letting your attention be turned away from stuff that isn't good, away from stuff that isn't helpful. Now look, how is this different from... education today? That's a big question. The obvious is this is couched in a Christian system of belief, but even you could subtract that and see some differences here. To say that the point of school is to train attention as a form of thinking and to care about your mistakes and not to care about merit, is this the world you all are living in at UVA? You can answer that even if you haven't read the book carefully. Yeah?
I think it goes with sort of academic studies. It's almost entirely like based in reason, whether you're just sort of absorbing information or you're, you know, experimenting and looking for conclusions. Whereas when you sort of delve into attention to God, you're kind of just jumping into the mysterium. There's not really kind of a there's no like answers that you're going to get that are it's such a different kind of answer.
A different kind of sense making or sense finding.
Yeah.
So but a very, very rationalistic approach to learning is not bad.
Right.
You would agree? You deserve to be applauded for your brilliance and your hard work, but a part of her message is, if that's the guiding clarity around education, you're going to miss the cultivation of attention, right? I picture her sitting down and going through all the syllabi at UVA. Where is the course objective of cultivating attentiveness? That would be humanities as well. Okay, what else? How is her philosophy of education different from ours today? And I ask the question because I'm also asking, how is her kind of philosophy of belief different from how clarities happen in the world today?
you notice a detail about muscular effort? Or someone want to comment on something else? Bottom of page 60. Leading you here to see maybe how she might critique you in love. Most often attention is confused with a kind of muscular effort. If one says to one's pupils, now you must pay attention, one sees them contracting their brows, holding their breath, stiffening their muscles. If after 2 minutes they are asked what they have been paying attention to, they cannot reply. They've been concentrating on nothing. They've been texting and checking their notes. Was in an earlier edition. They have not been paying attention. They have been contracting their muscles. We often expend this kind of muscular effort on our studies, as it ends by making us tired. We have the impression that we have been working. What does that mean? What is she saying there? Dude, I pulled an all-nighter. I've just been working so hard. Maybe not. Do you feel like you have to expend the muscular effort in your studies, or you're asked to? Yeah. So is she being naive here, or what is she saying?
I think she's kind of saying that we can fool ourselves by doing the work but not really focusing on it in the right way. So, like, in your example, yeah, you can pull an all-nighter, you know, but if you spend half of it, like, not really devoted to what you're doing, you say, oh, I spent 6 hours on it anyway, like, I put in the work, even though you weren't really paying attention.
Yeah. It's the way we confirm ourselves as achievers is by how exhausted we are or how busy we are. There was once when I was an undergrad that I was taking a class in symbolic logic, and I went on to do a PhD in philosophy, but symbolic logic was terrible for me. And I studied for 24 hours for the final exam, and I was earnest about it. I wasn't studying it with a view towards the love of God. No one had told me to do that. But I wasn't paying attention to it, maybe because I'm not very good at it, but I was impatient with what I was studying, but I thought if I keep going and going and going, it'll all click. Right? It wasn't a horrible thing I did. It was just kind of, I was missing the point of you by giving your attention to a subject, you learn how to pay attention to bigger things. But the deceptive illusion is, I give my attention in a way that I'm like a vacuum cleaner of information. And that is knowledge. That is learning it. Right? What's the point of just stockpiling information? That's not knowledge. You're asked to do that. I get it. That's not wisdom. That's not going to get you to wisdom. So, her end game in all this is, again, remember, to be thinking about attention giving as crucial to our experience of stuff that matters. If we don't curate, like, if we don't steward our attentiveness, it's going to be stewarded by other things. Right? I challenge you to ask yourself, how many opinions of yours, first, do you have any opinions? That's one thing to ask yourself. I wager you do. But where did they come from? Usually it's a mix of you being smart and thinking about things and stuff you've absorbed from the various communities or experiences around you. And it doesn't have to be a good or bad thing, but my point is, I'm trying to make Vay's point, that attentiveness is shaped as much as it is chosen. If not more, our attentiveness is shaped, right? We seek a refuge as people in clarities. Even if you're one of these people that says, look, I don't have an opinion on big issues. I don't know. I mean, everything is, I'm open to anything.
That may be, but you still really do long for certainty about big, hard questions. And you long for certainty about political issues. In other words, I think a part of her, we could say her psychological insight is that we want sense to be made. We want sense to be made of life. And we're gonna rush to find that. We're not gonna wait. We're not gonna wait and be careful about it. So she says, you know, I think a way to track the essay is to say she does want our highest part of our attention to be turned toward God. God has to help turn it there, but we have to help that happen. And then it doesn't stop. When one turns their attention to God, it also turns their attention back to all the crappy stuff in this world and what she hopes to be a way of justice, a way of redemption, a path of righteousness. But we have to do some things in order to do that. We have to see the relationship between studies and prayer. And to get that point, we have to see that faith is the condition of knowledge, she says. Faith is the condition of knowledge. I don't think she means you have to be a Christian in order to get knowledge. I think she means I have to believe in the Pythagorean theorem in order to have the knowledge this proof will offer me. Even that kind of a lowercase faith. We believe a lot of things, even scientifically, that aren't always demonstrable. You have to have a faith in language in order to make an argument, a faith that there is meaning in language. Okay, so faith is a condition to knowledge, but also, yes, for her, the Christian faith is the condition for wisdom. And in order to do that, we have to get our thinking into a position of waiting. Waiting to receive truth. And we have to work on waiting. Waiting is a form of paying attention. Paying attention is a form of waiting. And don't forget desire. All of this, and she's clear on this on page 61, is about a nervousness about the volatility of human desire. Alright, I think I've gone on too much, but I have about another minute. What question would you want to ask Simone Bay? Or what reaction are you stuck on to this? What hesitancy might you have?
I wonder if she would think if she's at risk of almost overanalyzing. That, like, she's not giving enough credence to just experience as, like, portraying truth. Mm-hmm. That you need to analyze and focus to really get at things without kind of, I don't know, we did talk about the Mysterium Tremendum with Otto, like, that kind of experience that you just feel and you kind of, I don't know.
A kind of attentiveness that's open to experiential knowledge, you're saying?
Yeah.
Question. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm not going to keep you over. So we'll stop there. But I just invite you to keep track of the questions you have for her. Because she needs to be questioned too. All right, thanks a lot, everyone.